was the famous trumpet man from all Chicago way. He had a boogie style that no one else could play. He was the top man at his craft. But then his number came up and he was gone with the draft. He's in the army now.
Today's Veterans Radio program is dedicated to the memory of Patty Andrews, the last of the Andrews sisters who passed away last week at the age of 94. You're listening to Veterans Radio.
From the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, this is Veterans Radio. And now, here's your host, Dale Fromberg.
And good morning, America, and welcome to Veterans Radio. And as they say, today is a very important day. Rise and shine, folks. It's Groundhog Day. And I just heard the news that Punxsutawney Phil did not see his shadow. But that's good, because that means that spring is coming sooner than later. And I don't know about where you're living, but here in Michigan, it's about 2 degrees, and it's snowing. So we're all excited that maybe spring will arrive a little bit sooner. We hope so. Welcome to Veterans Radio today. We've got a great program lined up for you. We're going to be talking about the 45th anniversary of the Tet Offensive. And for those of you that were around in 1968, it's a date that you will not forget in your lifetime. I know in mine I certainly won't. I was not in Vietnam in 1968. I didn't get there until December of that same year, and we only had I wouldn't call it a minor Tet 2 during 1969, but my understanding is that it was nothing in comparison. We're going to be taking a look at the history of the Tet Offensive and, really, did we win the battle and lose the war, or was this really that well planned out by the North Vietnamese? I think you're going to be surprised when you hear the answer. Our guests are going to include a Colonel James Wilbanks, who is the Director of the Department of Military History at the Command and General Staff College at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. We're going to have him on a little bit later on. Mike Mullins is going to be on, and I brought Mike on because he's a commentator, and he's also a Vietnam veteran, but he's also got some really good, strong opinions that he backs up with facts. And Mike and I have always had a good time talking about these issues on Veterans Radio, and so I'm excited to have Mike on a little bit later on, too. If you were there in Vietnam in 1968 on January 31st, give us a call today on Veterans Radio at 877-573-7825. 877-573-7825. We'd like to hear about what your experience was like during that Tet Offensive. We've seen movies, we've read books, but we want to talk to you about that if we can. And I think it's very important that people understand the ramifications of the Tet Offensive on both sides of the Vietnam conflict. Notice I didn't even say war this time. Uh-oh, I'm getting politically correct here. I better be careful. We want you to call in. I think this is an exciting topic, and I think you're going to be amazed about what you're going to learn today. I do have one event coming up, though, that I wanted to remind people of, and in your local area, there's probably something going on at your local VA Medical Center for Valentine's Week. Actually, it's Veterans Week coming up, not this coming week, but the following week, February 10th. And local area, at February 10th, the Valentine's for Veterans concert at Eastern Michigan University's Pease Auditorium on Sunday, February 10th at 2 p.m. This is a free concert for veterans and for civilians alike, and it's featuring Aaron Tippin, a country western music star, and all kinds of music. I'm sure there'll be lots of patriotic music, and we may even run into a few friends at the Valentine's for Veterans concert at Eastern Michigan University, Pease Auditorium, 2 o'clock on Sunday, February 10th. If you'd like to get tickets, because they are complimentary for everyone now, give a call to 734-222-7994. 734-222-7994. It's a great opportunity to support your local veterans here in the Southeast Michigan area, and I'm sure that there are programs going on at VAs all over the country for that week. We're going to be coming back in just a moment and talking about Tet, 1968. What really happened? Did the U.S. forces win the battle and lose the war? I don't know. We'll have to find out. You're listening to Veterans Radio.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill. The benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
We are back on Veterans Radio. Before we get to the lyrics of Black is Black, we always like to play songs that are appropriate to the time period we're talking about. And we're going to be talking about Tet, 1968 today. And as I mentioned earlier, our guests are going to include Lieutenant Colonel James Wilbanks, who's written a great book about the Tet Offensive. And he's a historian and he's an instructor at the Command and General Staff College of Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. Mike Mullins is going to be on. Unfortunately, we just got a call from Joe Galloway that he had a minor emergency and will not be able to be on the program this morning. So we're encouraging you to give us a call today here at Veterans Radio at 877-573-7825. All right. The book I'm going to talk about, first of all, is called The Tet Offensive, A Concise History by James H. Wilbanks. And a little quote from there, it says, in the Tet Offensive of 1968, Viet Cong and North Vietnamese forces launched a massive countrywide attack on South Vietnam. Though the communists failed to achieve their tactical and operational objectives, Colonel Wilbanks claims that Hanoi won a strategic victory. The offensive proved that America's progress was grossly overstated and caused many American and key presidential advisors to question the wisdom of prolonging combat. So coming on to Veterans Radio right now, I want to welcome Lieutenant Colonel James Wilbanks. Colonel Wilbanks, good morning, sir.
Good morning.
How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. You?
I'm cold. Other than that, we're doing terrific. I wanted to thank you for writing this book. I was complaining to the other my staff here today that I had just received it yesterday instead of Wednesday when they promised it, and I didn't get a chance to read the whole thing. But boy, I was engrossed last night in this story. Can you tell me tell our audience a little bit about the Tet Offensive and the planning and so forth that led up to it?
Well, the planning for the Tet Offensive began in 1967. And the planning, of course, started in Hanoi. There was some discussion about the way forward for the other side, the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese. There are really two factions within the Politburo. One faction wanted to go for an all-out attack. The other faction wished to continue the protracted warfare approach. And in the end, those who were proponents for the all-out attack won the argument, and that resulted in the Tet Offensive.
Well, I noticed in the parts that I was able to read last night that the General Giap, I believe it was the overall commander for this, and he didn't necessarily want to have this Tet Offensive the way that the Politburo wanted it, is it? Is that correct?
No, actually the proponent was another general who was the commander of Cosvin down in the south, the central office for South Vietnam. And he and one of the other leaders, Lê Duẩn, in Hanoi, in the Politburo, were the proponents for the all-out attack. Excuse me. Giap counseled to be a little bit more cautious and continue with the protracted approach. In the end, Nguyen Chi Tan died from pneumonia en route to Hanoi to plan the operation, and then the Politburo turned to Giap and told him that he was in charge.
Well, I'll tell the people that Colonel Wilbanks is recovering from some whatever we all getting this time of year. It sounds like.
No, I'm just getting over the flu. I'll try to persevere here, though.
I greatly
that, and it's extremely cold here in Kansas right now.
I know it's global warming, right? I don't think we're going to believe that one for a little while. Anyhow, getting back to this. So early in 1967, the North Vietnamese decided that that they needed to do this major offensive. What were the purposes of this?
Well, the purposes, those who were proponents of it clearly believed it could be a war-winning strategy. The only way they convinced themselves of that was to couple the attack with a general uprising by the people in South Vietnam. Otherwise, it didn't make much sense militarily, because if you looked at the combat ratios, the Americans, South Vietnamese, and the other free world military forces clearly outnumbered the other side in the South, particularly in terms of firepower. There are some people in the South who've been fighting the Americans and the South Vietnamese who are questioning the idea of going forward with such a large-scale attack, and they're basically accused of subjective thinking and told essentially to keep rolling. So once they've convinced themselves that this is going to work, then it takes on a new life of itself, and ultimately 80,000 soldiers, enemy soldiers, are involved.
How did they get all these soldiers and supplies into South Vietnam?
Well, they'd been going down the Ho Chi Minh Trail since before, and you know, the early 1960s. Initially, at the end of the First Indochina War, they left somewhere between 5,000 and 10,000 cadre in the South that became essentially what we call the Viet Cong, and they had been strengthening those forces. And then after 1960 or 64, late 64, moving North Vietnamese main force troops into South Vietnam. We were never able to cut the Ho Chi Minh Trail, so it continued to be a line of communication, a line of supply, if you will, for the North Vietnamese throughout the war.
I guess for our civilian audiences, we should point out that the Ho Chi Minh Trail came down from North Vietnam, ran through Laos and Cambodia before it entered back into South Vietnam. And due to, I guess, I don't know, political reasons that we were not allowed to go into Laos and Cambodia and to just destroy the trail. Is that correct?
With two exceptions. In 1970, Nixon sent U.S. and South Vietnamese forces into Cambodia. Very disruptive raid that took out many of the base camps and sanctuaries in Cambodia. And then in 1971, South Vietnamese forces, about 20,000, went down Highway 9 from Khe Sanh into Laos to Chaphon and attacked that part of the Ho Chi Minh Trail. U.S. forces were not permitted on the ground because of congressional legislation, but we've supported it with massive amounts of air support, helicopters, and artillery firing from within South Vietnam into Laos. But the bottom line was, if you could not occupy the Ho Chi Minh Trail, then it was very difficult to cut. We bombed it for essentially the length of the entire war, but we were never really able to cut it off.
Right. The units that I worked with would go into Cambodia and do things that they weren't supposed to talk about. And I'm not supposed to talk about, I guess. But to kind of disrupt the trail and all these other things. And they would say that the bombings would come through, the trail would be destroyed, and before the morning they had rebuilt it again. And
well, the problem was it wasn't really a trail. It was more like a capillary system. So there might be three or four laterals running north to south, and you could take out one with a B-52 strike, and basically they could move over 1,500 meters and keep moving south. And meanwhile, after the bombing was over, they had a large amount of troops that were there just to maintain and secure the trail. They would go back and repair the trail. So our guys who were bombing the trail bombed the same places over and over again. If you couldn't send troops in there to essentially clean out the sanctuaries, then the war sustains itself forever.
Right.
And that was always one of the problems. We were fighting a limited war. They were fighting a total war.
There was their initial attack, or their objectives in the book, mentioned that there were three main objectives. The first was to cause this big uprising and hopefully get, the South Vietnamese to fall on their side. What were the other ones?
Well, essentially, the fall of the Saigon government was the ultimate prize. The unstated one, or at least the ancillary reason, would be to demonstrate to the United States that the war was not winnable. And in a sense, they do achieve that, at least to a large part of the American public. So despite the fact that they're defeated soundly during the fighting, which, by the way, extends up into the fall, that was really three phases. The one that gets the popular conception of Tet is, of course, the early fighting in 68, but the fighting does continue up into the end of September, early part of October. And they lose over 40,000 troops. I got to Vietnam in 1971, and I never saw Viet Cong because militarily where I was, they were insignificant. They had been wiped out there in 68.
Yeah, I can understand that. I mean, I got there in 69, and they were still there, but not in as great in numbers as they had been in the previous part of that. So we're encouraging people to give us a call. We do have a caller on the line, and let me bring him on. And this is Tom from Michigan.
Yeah.
How you doing, Tom?
Good, Dale. Nice to hear from you.
Nice to hear from you also. I understand that you were in Vietnam during Tet.
Well, actually, we got there February 14th, and it was total chaos. We thought we were going to go up to Khe Sanh and relieve the 26th Marines. We were the 7th. And our first battalion fought major battles in Hue. We stayed right around Marble Mountain. And then, in May of 68, what we called the mini-Tet, we were on the island, which we wanted to...
Tom, I'm losing you. Can I ask you to hang up and call back, and maybe we can get a little bit better connection?
Okay.
All right, sorry.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks. Thank you. Anyways, so Tom was a Marine sniper, I know, in Vietnam during that time period. And you had mentioned, we're talking with Colonel James Wilbanks, whose book is The Tet Offensive, A Concise History, about what was going on. And Tom brought this up about Khe Sanh. Can you talk a little bit about the attack on Khe Sanh?
Yes, there was a big North Vietnamese buildup beginning at the end of 1967, the first couple of weeks of January 68. This drew everyone's attention, primarily because in Khe Sanh, when you look at it on the map, looks a lot like Dien Bien Phu. Mm-hmm. It's out at the end of a long line of communication up against the Laotian border. So there were many parallels that were drawn in the media, as well as in the White House, between Khe Sanh and Dien Bien Phu. Westmoreland thought that was where the main attack was going to come. He continued to believe that even into the first week of the Tet Offensive. There's a lot of discussion in the historiography about what was really going on there. It looks like it was a great misdirection play to focus everyone's attention away from the populated areas, which would be the focus of the Tet Offensive. But essentially, 20,000 North Vietnamese surrounded Khe Sanh. The differences between Khe Sanh and Dien Bien Phu is that rather than like the French who stayed down in the low ground, the Marines occupied the high ground that surrounded Khe Sanh, and there were lots of sharp fighting there. So that was the biggest battle in town. It began the initial shelling, if I remember right, began on 21 January. Mm-hmm. So fully about 9 to 10 days before the main attack came.
Well, the North Vietnamese also were having all these little probing attacks up and down Vietnam, weren't they?
Well, they had done that all along. They had prepared the battlefield pretty well in 1967. There had been a number of battles, the siege of the Marines at Con Tinh on the DMZ, the earlier fights around Khe Sanh, which were known as the Hill Fights, battles at Song Bay and Loc Ninh up against the Cambodian border, Military Region 3, and then a giant battle in November at Dak Tho. And these were what we would call today in Army doctrine shaping operations, meant to pull the focus of the American High Command away from the populated centers and out into, if you put these on a map, these are all along the DMZ and along the Laotian and Cambodian borders. So there was a wholesale repositioning of U.S. forces to respond to these actions. And essentially by the time of Khe Sanh, you've got a large percentage of the U.S. forces are located in ICOR in response to these movements and the build-up at Khe Sanh.
Well, that was obviously a major battle, and many of us are very familiar with the battle for Khe Sanh. I've got Tom back on the line. I'm going to try again here. Okay, Tom?
Can you hear me, Dale?
Yep, that's better.
Anyway, we had the battle for Golanoy Island in the mini tent that started about May 17th. It went on for about 10, 12 days. And we took a lot of casualties, wounded and dead, but also we lost a lot to the heat. It was enormously hot and stupid, so that we had to, we buried our flak jacket, we got rid of our gas mask, and we had to travel at night because of the heat. Was just a lot of people were dropping off, and they would pick them up in helicopters, take them off the island for a couple of days, get them ice, and bring them back on the island. But it was really, really a mess in May of '68 for me.
Okay. Well, I know in talking with you, Tom, that this is a very traumatic time for you, as it was for everybody else that happened to be there. And I want to thank you for calling into Veterans Radio and sharing this with us. Thanks, Tom.
You bet, Dale. Take care.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
We've got another caller on the line. I've got a Christine from Rochester, Michigan. Hold on here. Christine, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I have a little different perspective because I was not in Vietnam during the war, but my daughter-in-law is Vietnamese. Her family supported the Americans. Her father was in prison for 8 years and then came when they made the agreement to get them out and churches sponsored them. I went to Vietnam, well, maybe it's been about 5 years ago, and it was very interesting because I met, you know, part of the family that supported the Americans. I met part of the family that supported the Viet Cong. And we were so graciously received by everyone. And we traveled from Saigon up to Hanoi, all the different new places along there. And my daughter-in-law is from Trang Bang, which is, I think everybody kind of knows where that is, near the Cu Chi Tunnels. And so we were out in the villages there and everywhere. Everywhere we went, we were met with, if they were from the south, oh, we miss the veterans, you know, or here. We'd like to see our friends again. When we were up in the north, it was, oh, no, we don't hold a grudge. You know, we didn't want to fight. We had to fight. But we don't hold a grudge. Every 100 years, somebody comes and tries to take us over. So, you know, no, that's, you know, those things just happen. The other thing we found was they love to have the veterans come back because they are learning things they didn't know about the war.
Mm-hmm.
We were at that the part where Ho Chi Minh was supposed to have lived with a tour guide, and she told us that she was showing, you know, their tour with some veterans, and she told, you know, this is where he lived, and one of the men said, no, no, he didn't live here. He lived over there in that most expensive hotel in Hanoi.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, no, no, no. And he said, yes, and he pulled out papers that he had gotten during the war and proved this. So these are, there are a lot of things they're learning. We were at a, it was a temple or pagoda or something, and another tour guide, and she pointed out all the destruction, and you know, she's never been able to rebuild this. And I said, oh, that's too bad that they didn't let us come back in, because I'm sure our Corps of Engineers would have found out how to rebuild it. And she said, what, come back after the war and rebuild? And I said, oh, yes, any place that the Americans have had a conflict with, they've always gone back and rebuilt it. And she was shocked. And, you know, why didn't they let you come in? And I said, well, they just didn't let us come in. So, you know, if any veterans are worried about going back, don't. I wish I would have known that Gary Lilly was going before he went, because I would have gotten, you know, relatives of my my daughter-in-law to take him around. And when we were there, there was...
I got to cut you off here.
Okay.
But I want to thank you very much for giving us a call, and thanks for calling us here on Veterans Radio.
Okay, thank you. Enjoy your program. Bye.
This is a story we've heard from a lot of veterans who have gone back to Vietnam, is that they have, you know, been well-received. And that's great. And reminding you out there to give us a call here on Veterans Radio at 877-573-7825. And we are talking with Colonel James Wilbanks, who has authored The Tet Offensive, A Concise History. And we got you back on the air here, Colonel Wilbanks. Tell me a little bit about the... we know about Khe Sanh, and I was listening to Tom talking about getting rid of his... you know, his flak jacket and his gas mask. And one of the things that I read was that when they were attacking Khe Sanh, and they were, I mean, just showering it with artillery and mortars and everything else, that they did hit a supply of CS gas.
Essentially they hit the ammo dump, and in the ammo dump was some CS gas, which I'm sure made it uncomfortable for the Marines, at least until it dissipated.
I can only imagine. I landed one time in an LZ that, this was my mistake, that somebody had said was marked with white smoke. And I'm going, white smoke? What's white smoke? We've never seen white smoke before. And as we got closer, we found out it was a CS grenade that somebody had thrown out as a... yes. Anyway, one of those things that you remember. We've got a couple of minutes, though. We're going to take a break at the bottom of the hour, Colonel. And I wanted to talk about... Okay, so on January 31st, 1968... this Tet Offensive occurred, and where did it happen, and what, you know, what happened on that night?
Well, it actually started on the 30th. it was supposed to start on the 31st. There were targets that ranged from the DMZ to the tip of the Kamal Peninsula. They were all the populated areas and 23 bases and installations, including a number of course, in Saigon, Hue, and the Da Nang, the other larger cities. The reason that there was an earlier attack, and basically it was an area localized essentially around the southern part of I Corps and the northern part of II Corps, is, as it turned out, the forces were using two separate lunar calendars that were off by 24 hours. So part of the force launched 24 hours early. Now, that gave the American troops some, particularly in that area, some alert that, you know, something was coming because the attack started 24 hours early. It didn't help the Arvin much, because this was the Tet holiday, and a large preponderance of the Arvin forces were home on leave. So they couldn't be recalled in 24 hours. And then, of course, the offensive launched its full fury on the 31st. Up and down the length and breadth of Vietnam, General Wyan, who was in III Corps, said that the situation map lit up like a pinball machine, where all the contacts and all of the attacks were ongoing.
I can only imagine that. We're coming up on our first break right now. We're talking with Colonel James Wilbanks. His book is The Tet Offensive: A Concise History of What Really Occurred, and, you know, did we win that battle but lose the war as a result? And when we come back, I'm going to bring on Mike Mullins to talk a little bit about the role that the media played in this decision of how the Tet Offensive affected us. I'm interested to do that. Give us a call if you were there, 877-573-7825. You're listening to Veterans Radio. We'll be right back.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. First Lieutenant Jack Jacobs, although seriously wounded, made repeated trips across an open rice paddy, evacuating wounded and their weapons. Details after this.
Check it out, it's the Terminator. Hey, when'd you get back, huh?
Did you have to shoot anyone?
Why are you so distant? Are you not happy to see me?
So what's the deal? You gonna get a job now or what?
Why are you being so jumpy? Put all that stuff behind you, okay?
No one knows what it's like to come back from Iraq or Afghanistan unless they were there. Join other veterans at communityofveterans.org because we know where you're coming from. Brought to you by Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Jacob served as an assistant battalion advisor in Kien Phong Province, Republic of Vietnam. The battalion was advancing when it came under intense heavy machine gun and mortar fire. Jacobs called for and directed airstrikes on the enemy positions. Due to the intensity of the enemy fire and heavy casualties to the command group, including the company commander, the attack stopped and the friendly troops became disorganized. Wounded by mortar fragments, Jacobs assumed command of the company, ordered a withdrawal from the exposed position, and established a defensive perimeter. Despite heavy bleeding from head wounds that impaired his vision, Jacobs returned under intense fire to evacuate a seriously wounded advisor to safety, where he administered life-saving first aid. He then returned through heavy automatic weapons fire to evacuate the wounded company commander. Jacobs made repeated trips across the fire-swept open rice paddies, evacuating wounded and their weapons. On three separate occasions, Jacob drove off Viet Cong squads who were searching for Allied wounded and weapons, single-handedly killing three and wounding several others. His actions saved the lives of a U.S. advisor and 13 Allied soldiers. The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
Got a letter from LBJ. It says this is your lucky day. It's time to put your khaki trousers on. Though it may seem very clear, we've got no job to give you here, so we are sending you to Vietnam. Lyndon Johnson told the nation, have no fear of escalation. I am trying everyone to please. And
we are back on Veterans Radio, and we're talking about Tet 1968. This is the 45th anniversary of that huge offensive by the North Vietnamese that some people say worked and some people say it didn't work. And joining me on the line right now is my good friend Mike Mullins. And Mike, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Good morning, Dale.
How are you doing?
Hey, I'm doing fine. I'm enjoying listening to the Colonel.
He's got a lot of good things to say. I'm going to ask you to hold on the line for a little bit, Mike, and jump in when you feel like it. But I'm going to go back to Colonel Wilbanks. The attack occurs on, you know, the evening of Tet. All of the South Vietnamese theoretically are off on a break because it's a very big religious holiday and so forth. And in fact, in your book, I read something about 1789 that Vietnamese did the same thing to the Chinese.
That's correct.
I thought that. You know,
you might call it drinking your own bathwater, where you have decided the other side's on the ropes, so if you get indications that they're not on the ropes, you just discount it as a false report. And then, of course, if there is a buildup at Khe Sanh, which happens after in the early part of 68, if you begin to see, okay, maybe something is in the works, then what that something looks like is Khe Sanh. Mm-hmm. And then when the attack really breaks in all its fury from north to south on 30 and 31 January, it's totally unexpected.
Well, you know, the reason, the motivation for this program today is that obviously it's the anniversary of Tet. It's also because I read in the Vietnam magazine, and for all of you that are historians or historian wannabes, I would strongly suggest that you look at these magazines from the Weider Group, especially. This one was just called Vietnam, and it had some great articles in there, and it talked about how all of the troops were being moved all over the country to put out these fires in various places, and then Saigon was attacked. And that's one of the things that really got our attention. How could the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong get into the American embassy, even though they weren't there that long? Could you comment on that?
Well, Saigon's really only 65 miles away from the Cambodian border if you go down Highway 13 up Highway 13 to Analog. So the Parrotspeak even pushes further in to South Vietnam. So it's pretty easy run from the sanctuaries in Cambodia to Saigon, and they began moving those forces in the late 67 toward Saigon. And of course, a lot of the forces that were used inside the cities, particularly Saigon, were Viet Cong units, not North Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of interesting because General Nguyen, who commanded the 25th Infantry Division and then went on to be 2 Field Force Commander, thought that something was up. So he began to reposition some of his forces closer to Saigon, because Saigon essentially was left to the South Vietnamese to defend. We didn't have any combat troops in Saigon. But he moved a couple of his battalions, three-quarter cav, one of his cav outfits, a little bit closer, and those are the guys that were responded once the fighting started in Saigon, they and the Arvin, who were located in the area. So that turned out to be a success story, and of course, all of those troops who seized objectives in Saigon, they were all killed or captured, including the sappers inside the embassy.
Well,
the grounds of the embassy, they never actually made it. I think they made it into the bottom floor, but never above the ground floor, and they were all killed or captured.
Well, the story of the attack on Saigon is what so many people heard about here in the States, and I guess that's where I want to make this transition now to what was the story we were hearing here at home. And you talk about that as being one of the objectives of this Tet Offensive, that the North Vietnamese wanted the American people to know that things weren't going quite as smoothly as we thought.
Well, I think that was one of the objectives, was to show that the war was going to continue. It wasn't going to be over, as Westmoreland had said. In November he had said, essentially intimated, that in 2 years we would pretty much have it under control. And they were more than happy to prove that that wasn't the case. You make a very good point about the fighting in Saigon, because that's what's readily available to the news media. There were 636 newsmen, media personnel, who were accredited in Saigon on 31 January 68. Some of those were very good, like Joe Galloway, and some of them were not very experienced. So what you got was their perceptions of the war, and you didn't have to go anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
You could watch it from the top of the Rex Hotel. You could watch the fighting in Cholon, just a few miles away. Those very splashy pictures and those very splashy videos are what's on the news at 5:30 every night. And very often, the nature of the media is such that you don't go to page 13 for the rest of the story. And the rest of the story in the embassy fight is they're all dead or captured.
Right.
What you see is the fact that you've got 19 sappers inside the grounds of the U.S. embassy, the seat of American power in Vietnam. Those are pretty powerful images.
And that's very true, and that's what we were seeing. Colonel, I'm going to come back to you, but Mike, I want you to jump in on this, because the reason I asked you to be on today is that you had written an article a long time ago when you were starting to work on one of your books. I forget which one it was, but about our, Walter Cronkite. Let's talk about our, who was, everybody trusted this man, and we thought that, he would only give us the truth, and he made a line that, that the war had been lost. And I'll let you go on that, Mike.
Well, that was a major turning point. For most of us who served in the field, served in Vietnam, I got there in March. I was that replacement, basically, for the 199th, which was heavily engaged at the Putel Racetrack in Cholon.
So you were in Saigon.
Well, I got there later.
Yeah, but as we know, March, this thing was still in full blown right then.
Yes. 199th, where their primary duties had been. And in fact, they intercepted NVA moving in from the northwest prior to the main attack. And the several battalions, all of us at the 199th, were airlifted into the Cholon to take the racetrack back. Because the racetrack was a central point because there were five roads converged there. And was,
okay, I'm sorry. I got to interrupt here. Somebody's got either on speakerphone or we've got somebody that's talking that shouldn't be talking. So we're getting people we're laughing over each other. Mike, I'm sorry. All right, so you were the 199th, and you were at the racetrack.
Yeah, the 199th was, yes.
Okay.
And then they took the racetrack back from the VC. That was a key intersection for them for moving troops in and heavier armor and things. So I was, when I got there in March, the guys who broke me in had survived a lot of that. They'd fought at Long Bend. They'd fought there at Camp Frenzel Jones, which is the main base camp for the 199th, and then fought at Cholon. The perspective, when you brought up Cronkite, there are many of us who really resent the fact that he told the world we were losers when, in fact, we kicked the enemy out of that area. In fact, we ran him out of the country. But, you know, it was one of those things where we felt somebody that we'd trusted, and we were kids. We didn't know how seriously it was going to impact the people at home. And, you know, to tell the American public based on what he saw within a few blocks, rather than getting after battle reports and things like that to see how we'd really fared, he made an assumption and announced how bad it was and how badly we were doing in the middle of a fight. And there's a lot of underlying anger and resentment still today by a lot of guys who fought there and who went there right after.
Well, I can certainly understand that. I was talking to somebody here in the local Ann Arbor area about what their reaction was to the Tet Offensive as they were students here. And they just kind of felt like, well, see, we told you this is what was going to happen. And we need to get out of there, and we need to get out of there fast. And we got to take another break for both of you, Mike and Colonel Wilbanks. So I'm going to ask you to hang on the line. When we come back, I want to talk more about the role that the media played in the reaction to the Tet Offensive. We'll be right back. You're listening to Veterans Radio.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
We're back on Veterans Radio, the Country Joe and the Fish. We played the clean version of that song. We hope you appreciate that. And for many of us, that song kind of epitomized what was happening in Vietnam after the Tet Offensive. because Colonel Wilbanks, as you mentioned, we're talking with Colonel James Wilbanks, who's authored a book about the Tet Offensive, and we're talking with Mike Mullins, who has got into country in March of 68. It kind of, I don't know, I would think it would hurt recruiting and so forth. It certainly played with our minds. What are we doing there if we're not going to win, Colonel?
Well, I think you could look at a couple of polls that are really instructive. If you look at November 67, 50% of those who took the poll thought that the United States was making progress in Vietnam. In February 68, after the Tet Offensive hit, 61% thought that of Americans polled that we were losing or standing still. So I think the impact of the Tet Offensive was extremely large. It went a long way. If you were against the war, it certainly cemented those feelings. If you were on the fence, it perhaps pushed you the other direction, that even if you were prepared to give the Johnson administration the benefit of the doubt, based upon what they had told you in late 67, the images on TV, right or wrong, sort of said a different story, told you a different story.
Well, that is certainly true. Mike, any comments on that?
Well, the soldier didn't lose it. Politicians and the press did. Because it wasn't, in fact, we lost that war. There was no peace with honor.
Mm-hmm.
The fighting that was done was never reported in a positive light. Everything that, the information that was going home to the American public was that we were a bunch of losers and we had a bad battle plan. And, I'm not so sure they weren't accurate in that part.
The battle plan part, yes.
Yeah, but there were a lot of people who saw it coming and were prepared.
Mm-hmm.
You realize that nothing they intended to overrun was overrun.
Mm-hmm.
And their supply lines were completely destroyed. The Viet Cong were almost completely destroyed. And if we had been allowed to chase them back into the hole where they went, we could have dealt a serious blow to the North Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
So the limitations placed on us, the press should have been reporting not on our performance on the battlefield, but how our performance was being restricted.
Right.
And in most of our minds, or many of the people that I know and have communicated with, over the years, we're absolutely convinced that the press lost that. And everybody that came thereafter, later in 68, up into 69, thought they were coming to a losing effort. One of the lines I use, and I did write about this in my book, Out of the Mist, just briefly. But they felt, it's that syndrome of the kid on the playground. The last one chosen knows he's going to go to a losing team, and he really may rather go home.
Yeah.
And the emotional impact of those reports coming home, and then what we heard from home while we were in the field trying to do our thing, was a total disaster morale-wise. And, one of the lines that it was one of my favorite lines is, Cronkite, in a lot of ways, had a chance to be the Ernie Pyle of my generation,
mm-hmm.
which is also something I think Joe Galloway's a lot closer to than Cronkite ever was. But if Ernie Pyle had done what Cronkite did back in World War II, he could have stopped the sale of war bonds.
Oh,
there's that much impact in the pen.
I think it's important to point out, that 1968 was such a traumatic year for the country anyhow. And going back to you, Colonel Wilbanks, just fill in our audience on what happened to LBJ after Tet.
It's kind of interesting. General Wheeler, who's the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, convinces Westmoreland that he ought to ask for more troops. So he asked for 206,000 more troops. As you might expect, this doesn't go over very well in an unpopular war that half of America thinks we're losing. At the New Hampshire primary, Johnson wins by only 300 votes. So that convinces him that essentially his political career is over. So on 31 March, he goes on national TV and says he will not run, he will not accept his party's nomination, and that he will be done at the end of his term. But you make a very good point about what's going on in the United States. It's a very turbulent year. I was younger at that particular point. I was still in college at Texas A&M, and I thought the country was coming apart at the seams. Mm-hmm. You had Martin Luther King was assassinated. Bobby Kennedy was assassinated. You had riots in the street at the Chicago Democratic National Convention in the fall. And it looked like the whole country was falling apart at the seams.
Absolutely. I know exactly what you mean. I was going through flight training at the time in Texas, and you know, we were constantly said that we needed to be on alert because Dallas was going to, you know, go up in flames over, you know, a demonstration over this or whatever it happened to be. And it was just so frightening to think about what was happening to our country. And here we're going, in my mind at the time, and I'm going to go off and fight these bad guys 10,000 miles away. It'd be nice if we could straighten a few things out here before we do that. And I think that that's probably one of the analogies that we can make to what's happening, in not to the same extent, but happening in the world today. You know, what was our plan there? And Mike, I heard you mention this earlier, is that they wouldn't let us finish the job.
Exactly. They stopped us. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the major mistakes was actually predicated Korea, taking ground and giving it back.
Yep.
You know, rather than measuring our progress with ground taken and secured, we measured it in body count. Mm-hmm. And all of us resented having to do body counts. You know, in April, my unit stumbled into a sapper battalion, and we whipped them. There were three elements, three companies of my battalion, and one of our units that was flanking us was at the center of the battle. And in chasing them down the road, so to speak, they were made to count, stop and count bodies that had been stuffed in a well.
Oh, geez.
You know, the measuring stick that was chosen was a poor way of doing business, in my mind, and in our minds at the time. We would rather have won than stopped and counted.
Absolutely.
You know, the day reports were full of body counts.
Mm-hmm. Well, Colonel Wilbanks, what do you think? We've got about 5 minutes left. And what lessons do you think that we've learned from Tet, if any?
Well, I think the biggest lesson, certainly for the serving military today, is to not build unrealistic expectations. I think part of the impact for the Tet Offensive was Westmoreland saying in November that there was a light at the end of the tunnel, that the war would be over in 2 years. There was still a lot of fighting. You know, I got there in 1971, and the war was still going on. So I think that senior leaders have to be very careful about describing the way ahead. And a good example of that, I think, was General Petraeus in Iraq at the time of the surge, where he was very, very cautious about saying that there are some hard days ahead. He said some progress is being made, but there are hard days ahead. And I think that, that he was a student of the Vietnam War, and I think he realized that the mistakes of Tet, was pretty clear that he wasn't going to make those in Iraq.
Yeah, we got to get our politicians to pay attention too to what's going on, because you know nobody can promise what's going to happen 6 months to a year down the road. Anyway, before I get up on that tangent myself, there. Well, Colonel Wilbanks, I know that you've written a lot of books about Vietnam and about, you know, not just the Tet Offensive, but you've got Ann Locke in there and so forth. Where could our audience get some of these books? Because they're fascinating to me.
Well, they're all on the usual book outlets, Barnes and Noble and Amazon.
And so, what's your next project?
I have a manuscript at Texas A&M Press right now on Lam Son 719, the attack into Laos by the South Vietnamese in 1971.
Okay, well, we're definitely going to have to get you back on that one. to talk about that. I think that's going to be a great story. I want to thank you so very much for being on Veterans Radio today, and I hope that you feel a lot better and that it warms up out there in Kansas.
Well, it will by June, I suppose.
Yeah, we can only hope so. Mike, what's going on with you right now? You can remind our audience of some of the books that you've got out that I know I've loved and read.
Well, Jim Greenwald and I have a new one coming out. I think he got the first shipment. So we'll have them available. It's called Pass Assault, Doc, and it's focused on PTSD.
Okay. And that's obviously a big issue that we need to address.
Yeah, I've got a son that's out there at Leavenworth right now going to the schools.
There you go.
Well, have him come by and see me. I'm the head of the history department on the second floor. He can't miss me.
I doubt that I'll be talking to him, but I'll send him a message. He made Command Sergeant Major back in October.
Excellent. Congratulations to him.
Well, he's had a good career and worked hard, and he'll have his demons like I have mine.
Well,
I have a young son who just got back a year ago from Afghanistan with 101st, and he's in the 1st Cav now.
Well, he's been with two good units.
Just continues. Warriors begat warriors. Nice.
Ain't it so? Thank God.
Nice going, gentlemen. Command Sergeant Major, for our civilian audience, that's the highest non-commissioned rank, isn't it? Like an E?
Yes, sir.
E whatever, 9?
Yes.
That's the highest pay grade. That's the top of the top for non-commissioned officers. Good job. Give them our congratulations, Mike.
And, you know, I appreciate what Dr. Will Banks is doing. And, you know, with the one thing, there's a perspective that's hard to record in history, and that's the emotional perspective of those in the mud. You know, we look at data, we look at day reports, and it's all cold and kind of remote. But somebody that's been there can put an extra touch on it, and that's what I try to do and what other people, and, well, I'm Military Writers Society, that's what we all do. And, I've never considered myself a historian, and certainly not in the way that the colonel is. But the perspective that we add to the mix is the gut. You know, you can see a lot of things with the mind, but you got to be able to feel them, too, to really understand.
You do. And, Mike, you do such a great job with that. I want to thank you again for being on Veterans Radio, and I know that you're always available. I want to have my resident expert on.
Well, don't call me an expert. I just know what I experienced and what I saw and what I hear from the guys when we get together so much.
That's true. Thank you very much for being on Veterans Radio, Mike. Colonel Will Banks will be in touch. We'll find out more about that new book that's coming out, and we'll be in touch with you also.
I enjoyed talking with you.
Thank you. I wanted to kind of remind our audience, it's what Mike was talking about, that one of the reasons we do this program is to get these original stories out from the people that were in the mud and so forth. And the person that called in earlier, Tom Falecki, was a sniper with the Marines during the Tet Offensive. And so, you know, upfront and personal perspective of what really occurred. That's what we do. If you've got a story, get a hold of us here on Veterans Radio, and we'll be glad to tell our audiences all about that. Next week, we're going to be talking about medics in Afghanistan. Join host Bob Gould here on Veterans Radio. Until then, you are dismissed.
All views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily of Veterans Radio or this station. Veterans Radio is a production of Veterans Radio, LLC.